Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome, everyone, to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me. And I'm thrilled today to welcome one of my favorite writers, Kevin Williamson of The Dispatch. Kevin was at National Review for years where we sort of overlapped. I wasn't technically there, but I used to participate in a lot of National Review events. And I was kind of a member of the family until they kicked me out. And anyway, Kevin, you are such an amazing writer. What people may not know about you, well, there's probably a long list of things, but you...
A lot of those things I like to keep on that list, by the way.
Well, we'll see. Anything you don't want to anything you don't want me to dwell on, you just tell me. But so you were born and raised in Texas. You fell in love with economics, I imagine, in like high school. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I had a high school econ class. We had a required economics class to graduate from high school back in the 80s and 90s in Texas. And it was taught by a coach who had us, because all classes are taught by coaches that aren't math and science in Texas, as everyone knows.
And, I had a coach for biology in New Jersey, so I know where, yeah, know what you're talking about.
And one of the books he assigned us was Milton Friedman's Free to Choose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny, I'd already been reading National Review and some other things like that at that point, because I was exactly that kind of nerd. But, you know, I kind of read the back half of National Review mainly. So for me, National Review was a magazine that was about language and culture and books and things like that. And there's some politics stuff at the beginning that I didn't really follow all that closely. And I already kind of had the same sort of libertarian ideas that you'll find in Free to Choose. But it was really my first contact with a kind of rigorously argued, systematic economic approach to these policy questions. And it really, really stuck with me. And it wasn't really such a – people thought – libertarians are like libertarianism is a pseudo religion, as you know, and yeah. Libertarians will talk about their conversion experiences. And like for the bad kind, it's reading Ayn Rand, and for other people, it's something else, like getting a job and P.G. O'Rourke and his famous story about his first paycheck and seeing what was taken out and gave up being a Marxist that day. But for me, it wasn't so much a conversion as it was a confirmation. You know, I had sort of incoherent and vague ideas about the world, but they were vague ideas that aligned with what I discovered in that. And I got really interested in sort of an economic approach to these kinds of questions. And I read a lot of economics for a while in college. I was an econ major until I had a professor do me the great favor of explaining to me why I shouldn't be an econ major.
And what did he or she say?
He said, do you know what you do with an undergraduate degree in economics? And I said, actually, I have no idea. He said, well, you can maybe go work on Wall Street if you want to, but that's definitely not you. Or you get a PhD in economics, which is basically getting a PhD in math. Does that sound like something that you would find fun or that you would be good at? And I said, no, not really. And he said, but you do like working in the student newspaper. I said, yeah, I do. And I said, go do that. And he was right. I would have been a failed graduate student in economics And I probably would have failed at some second or third tier program because I wouldn't have gotten into a very good one.
I have my doubts about that, but
that's in the imaginary world, which I actually got an undergraduate degree, so which still hasn't happened. I'm going to get around to that one of these days. But
so you went off to India and edited a newspaper, right?
Yeah, I was an editor at the Indian Express newspaper group, which published at that time an English language newspaper in 37 cities, and then a whole bunch of local language newspapers. I think we published in, maybe 30 languages or something, or a couple of dozen languages at least. All in, it was a huge, huge operation with these just gigantic press runs that would go just day and night. And they were first, this was the mid-90s, and they were installing desktop publishing systems. And I had done that in college. And a lot of people have gone through this, I think, in my generation and subsequent generations, where I was the tech guy there for a while. Like, if you wanted to figure out how to go from the old crazy, you know, DOS-based systems they used to have to Quark or other desktop publishing systems, like, I was the guy you called. And so I helped walk them through that. And I wrote a column and did some other stuff for them and did some training of editors and things. Tremendously fun job. I loved India. It was a great place to be a newspaper guy. I get the feeling that being a newspaper editor in India in the 1990s was probably like what it was in the United States in maybe like the 1920s, where newspapers really mattered. Mm. And, you know, every educated household got 4 or 5 or 6 newspapers a day. It was a real, a really great, great experience for me. I was an illegal immigrant, of course, because there were no laws allowing foreigners to work in the press in India at the time. And I hope I'm not getting any of my former colleagues in trouble because some of them are still around. But, let's say my immigration paperwork never got regularized.
And fortunately, they didn't bundle you off to a gulag in El Salvador for that crime.
They did arrest my girlfriend at one point, the girl I was dating. She was on a plane to Germany, I guess, and they pulled her off the plane and held her on immigration irregularities because they wanted her to have an exit visa.
Was she from India or from?
No, she was an American. And I believe the necessary bribe to make that go away was like $40 or something. So it was a very affordable place.
I love the story that your colleague, Jonah Goldberg, tells about his dad telling him how to handle being pulled over by a police officer. You know the story. You tell it.
I don't remember exactly how.
Jonah said it, but, it's something. I may be getting it wrong, but it's something along the lines of if you're in a foreign country, or maybe it was even here. I don't remember, but if you're pulled over by a cop,
Settle in cash and settle there.
It's sort of like, oh, officer, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize, and I'm in a big rush, and I know it would take time to go down to. Could we just settle this here? Right,
yeah. I tried that on occasion, and it doesn't work in the United States.
Well, that is one of the great strengths of this country, which is actually, this is something to talk about. Actually, it's not that. Not that traditional. I mean, there was a lot of corruption for a very long time in America. And we went through some really dramatic reform movements, including the progressive movement, where we attempted to clean up stuff like that. Because that is kind of the way of the world in a lot of places, even still today, right? And it impedes economic growth.
It does. Places like France and Italy and have they're advanced modern countries, but they still have a reputation for that kind of thing. Or not even just, minor traffic stuff, but when it comes to big things like licensing for businesses and stuff like that, or immigration paperwork, I know people have talked about being asked for bribes in Italy specifically. So, there's this really interesting period in American history. I'm very interested in Dwight Eisenhower and the kind of immediate post-war years. And after World War II, there was this great sense that American government was competent and that there was this great sense of a false sense, I think, by the way, of the possibility of kind of enlightened, rational, scientific approach to things. We really thought that the war years had shown that you can just bring all the smartest guys in the world, put them in a room together and lock them up in a basement in New Mexico somewhere. And
it wasn't a crazy conclusion after the Manhattan Project.
World War II is the great example, right? That's like, although if you go back and look at like contracting and procurement stuff from World War II. It's a goat rodeo. It's bad stuff. But so we come out of the war thinking that we're going to have this different sort of culture and this different sort of way of conducting all sorts of public business. That's really where the modern cult of objectivity in newspapers comes from. As in the immediate post-war years, there's a sense that newspapers are going to be the public voice of this kind of disinterested scientific expertise. And that brought along with it some bad things in terms of misbegotten ideas of what government can actually do and accomplish in the public sector and in terms of economic planning. But it also brought some good things in terms of expectations about probity and openness and transparency in government. And in that kind of environment, the small town traffic cop taking a bribe to not write you up for running a stop sign just became really, really hard to maintain culturally. And a lot of that stuff really did go away in those years and hopefully will not come back. Although there are some, I mean, you can give the president an airplane now, apparently, which.
Yes.
If you wanted to bribe me, that'd be the way to bribe me.
Like, a $400 million
It doesn't
airplane.
Have to even be that one. Just, Kevin, you never have to fly commercial again. I'd like to think I don't have a price, but if I do have a price, it's right around there.
That's funny you say that, because I can so identify with this, because I've often said that, when people, so we went to visit some friends in Florida recently, and there was a certain amount of real estate porn, look at that house and look at that and look at that. And my feeling was, and has always been, I do not envy the rich, their huge palace homes. Have no interest in that. Who dusts all that? No. But the thing that I envy is the ease of life that, yes. They have somebody who drives up and picks them up and takes them to the airport, and they get on a private plane and they don't go through security and they don't have to stress about it. That kind of thing. I do have a certain, in my fantasies, that's what I would long for, the ease of things.
I've told this story before, so I'm probably boring some people. It is a recurring conversation between me and my wife that, if our income were twice what it is, it probably wouldn't change much about the way we live. If it were three times what it is, we'd probably live in the same house. We'd drive the same cars. We'd wear the same kinds of clothes and stuff. We'd probably have better retirement savings. But if it were 1,000 times what it is, we'd have the airplane.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the only way to make that, there's no middle ground between those things, right? Like, you can be, short of being, like a Fox News anchor or something like that, having that kind of thing, there's not really much you can do in our business that that puts you in that kind of income. And there's no kind of halfway point. There's no, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times what you make as a, even as a pretty well-paid political journalist is nowhere near the threshold for that kind of stuff.
No, it definitely is not. But and there is an inverse ratio between the amount of integrity you have and the amount of money you are capable of earning.
I don't know that that's necessarily true.
I know some poor people
who have no standards at all.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But when you think about certain people who are Fox News celebrities, they got that way by jettisoning their
principles.
To
make your money that way is difficult. But
And
not to dwell too long on our own particular journalistic class anxieties and such, but I do think this is actually a part of the this is a part of the reason for the kind of weird toxic element of class envy in our politics, which isn't just on the left anymore. It used to be a very left thing, but now it's on both sides. Nobody is really all that upset about people whose lives are radically different from theirs. They're upset about people who are kind of culturally adjacent to them, but not financially adjacent. So if you're someone who lives in Muleshoe, Texas, and you work on a farm, and you make, $70,000 or $80,000 a year, it's a comfortable life in Muleshoe, Texas, you're not worried about what someone who works as a consultant or a lobbyist in Washington makes in his $800,000 or $900,000 a year. But if you're a journalist and you make, your household income might be, if you're in D.C., $500,000 a year for some of these folks, so two people making $250,000 a year, that's not a crazy amount of money. Or you are someone who's, two married college professors or something like that. Your world has some people in it who have that private plane money. And that's how you learn to envy, is you learn to envy by, you know, what I'm going to do the whole Hannibal Lecter thing here. How do we learn to covet, Clarice? We learn by coveting what we see every day. It's people get upset about things that are actually in their world. No one hates someone who makes $500,000 a year nearly as much as a guy who makes $450,000 a year does.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Because at the same time that is certainly a phenomenon, there is also, you see it in polls all the time, that people radically misunderstand or miscalculate how much other people make.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, what is rich and what isn't. And they tend to think that everybody who is of a different political persuasion is cashing in, mm-hmm. right, somehow. And so there's that phenomenon.
Did you know that 99% of the chicken, 95% of the pork, and 78% of cattle are raised in feedlot or confinement buildings? Or that over 80% of the antibiotics in the U.S. are fed to animals? That's why Moink is so great. The business is simple. Moink's meat comes from animals raised outdoors, where a pig is free to be a pig. And their farmers are given an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. They deliver meat straight to your doorstep at prices you can actually afford. And it's all born, raised, and harvested right here in the United States. Moink is a fantastic way to support American farmers who provide the food we all eat. The meat is delicious, and the cause is even better. I love it, and you will too. Join the Moink movement today. Support American family farms and join the Moink movement today at moinkbox.com/Mona and get free wings for life. They're the best wings you'll ever taste, but it's only for a limited time. It's spelled Moink, M-O-I-N-K, box.com/Mona. That's moinkbox.com/Mona.
Let's zero in on a piece you recently wrote. I've often said when I'm praising you behind your back that you write with a pen dipped in acid. And it is so, it's in stark contrast to your personal presentation in podcasts and in person for that matter. But boy, your writing, it's just so sharp and pointed. So here's what you said about the question of regarding the second Trump term. You were writing about whether Americans voted for this or not. Mm. That a lot of people were saying, well, Americans didn't vote for this. They surely didn't know that this horror show that we're living through was in the cards. And you wrote, I will quote, "It is time, well past time, to stop making excuses for Americans' cruelty, for Americans' selfishness, for Americans' childish insistence on being led by their resentment and by their lowest instincts." And then bear with me, I'm going to read one more graph. This is a little lower down in the piece, but you were saying about the first Trump term, which we all lived through. From 2017 to 2021, the Trump administration offered a clown car parade of lying, lawlessness, incompetence, imbecility, corruption, cruelty, kookery, cowardice, and so much whining that you'd think they'd be sick of whining, even though they weren't. There was nobody eligible to vote in 2024 who wasn't walking the earth in the first Trump administration. Some people would say that while some people deserve this verdict, that a lot of voters are, you know, tuned out. They're only responding to the price of groceries and mortgages, and that your verdict on them is too harsh. What do you say to that?
I say it would be harsher, but Steve Hayes won't let me write some of that stuff in his language stuff anyway. No, I don't think that's really the case. So, but it's a little complicated. So there's some people who don't follow politics very closely, and that's fine. You don't have to. You know, as Bill Buckley once famously said, decent people would leave politics alone if we thought politics would leave us alone. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I've written and talked a lot about Switzerland and how much I kind of like their political culture in some ways. And one of my favorite things about it is like at any given moment, if you ask someone on the street who the president is, they won't know because it doesn't matter all that much because it's a pretty well-run country irrespective of who's in power. And they've also got a weird presidency, which is kind of not worth going into right now. So rational ignorance is a real thing. You know, rational ignorance is one of those terms from economics, which means that in terms of your ability to get something out of it, either in terms of a personal benefit or influencing the outcome of elections or policy decisions, for most people, learning a lot about politics or complicated policy issues is just not worth the effort. And it's better to spend an extra 5 hours a week working and earning a little extra money or spending some time with your kids or whatever that is. That's fine. I understand that. But politics doesn't just happen on election day. And people who are running for office are responding to the signals they get from the electorate, from the American people, and to the political culture that we have all collectively created. And I don't exempt myself, by the way, from any criticism. You know, when I criticize what's worst about American politics and American political habits, you know, some of that's me too. You know, I'm as much of an offender, more of an offender than most people, since I do this all damn day, and most people don't do it all damn day. But the culture we have created is one that I'm detecting an opening in the market here for the guy that Bill Bennett used to be. So let me try to fill it for a second. But there's a real opening here for the issue of, for lack of a better term, as ponderous as it sounds, civic virtue, right? Mm-hmm. Which is different from personal morality. They're not entirely disconnected from one another, but the civic virtues are things that are particularly applicable to politics and the public sphere. I've been writing a little book about this on Dwight Eisenhower and the idea of civic virtue. So Eisenhower is a good example of this because he's a guy who probably cheated on his wife during the war. We don't really know for sure, but it certainly looks like he probably did. And that's a real moral failing. But his virtues that were public facing are enormously consequential, and they were enormously consequential for the time. His humility regarding his role as a general and his role as a president, his idea of what it meant to be a person entrusted with that kind of power. These are important virtues to have. And they don't just matter to people who are in elected office or high elected office. They matter more to the citizen. You know, the whole idea of citizenship is that unlike a subject, citizens have power. And that means they also have responsibility. They have a sense of duty. They have honor. They have all these things that properly belong to someone who is not just being moved around on the chessboard by the great forces and great powers of the world. And if we had a different sort of conception of citizenship, which would come from having a different attitude toward the civic virtues, we would have a very different kind of political culture. Donald Trump became Donald Trump long before he ran for president because there's a market for that kind of thing in the United States. You know what? You couldn't make this stuff up, and I know because I've tried. I've tried to write fiction, like satire about American politics, and it's just impossible. I think there's a reason Chris Buckley hasn't probably published a book in a while, and even if Tom Wolfe were still with us, he couldn't do it.
Beyond parody, as the saying goes.
So Donald Trump is a guy whose youngest son is named after the imaginary friend he invented to lie to the New York Post about his sex life.
True.
That's weird. Like, normal people don't do stuff like that, right? And normal people don't behave that way. And but he became a major cultural figure by being that guy. And he was popular, you know, all across the culture. His television shows were pretty popular. He got shout outs in rap songs and things. You know, when you've got a reality show and you're in Nelly songs, you know, you're a pretty broad cultural figure, I think. And there's a reason for that, and that's because that's the kind of people we are. I mean, we've decided to become that kind of people. And this inevitably has an effect on our politics. And our culture is driven to an extraordinary degree by resentment and by selfishness and childishness and sort of basic unseriousness. And as a result, our politics is as well. So, you know, Donald Trump didn't come out of nowhere and like get imposed on the American people by some shadowy conspiracy of Russian billionaires or something, as much as some of my friends on the left want to tell themselves that story. He is an American phenomenon. He is as American as McDonald's and widespread diabetes. You know, he's a real product of how we live our lives and where we are as a people. And, and the Democrats have been punished by American politics recently and for their incompetence and their stupidity and their own particular problems. But they've got to laugh a little bit, right? Because they haven't experienced this on their side, really. And it's been a while since the Democrats have had a real demagogue like that. You know, it's been really, I guess, since George Wallace, since they've had a figure like that. And they were lucky enough that their demagogic figures came along at a time when you still had the blessed smoke-filled rooms. And we
you
need
know
more
what, Kevin,
rooms
I would just, can I just add that. A, can I interrupt to add a, please, yeah. a little footnote, which is they had an aspiring one, but he got scooped up by the GOP. That's RFK Jr.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. And in fact, the GOP is now so much the party of demagogues that it's almost as if any Democrat who begins to show those tendencies, you say, ah, they're headed for the exits. They're headed for the GOP. Tulsi Gabbard. Exactly. Yeah. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Let's talk numbers. Getting an in-person therapist can cost you $100 to $250 per session, and that adds up fast. But with BetterHelp online therapy, you can save an average of up to 50% per session. With BetterHelp, you pay a flat fee for weekly sessions, saving you big on cost and on time. Therapy isn't a luxury. It should be accessible. With online therapy, you get quality care at a price that makes sense and can help you with anything from anxiety to everyday stress. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. Your mental health is worth it, and now it's within reach. Personal therapy is something that everybody should take advantage of. It can save marriages. It can help with child rearing. It can help with your work relationships. There's always something that you can be doing better if you know yourself a little better. So, think about your own well-being and invest in it. Visit betterhelp.com/Mona to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Mona.
Yeah, the weird thing about the Republicans is that the people they really most resemble currently are the hippies. They really are kind of like the early to mid 1960s emergent counterculture, which, you know, ends with the Manson family, right? Really. And so they're kind of, you know, they're nihilistic, they're anti-establishment, they are anti-authority, they're anti-intellectual. They think that everything is sort of a fraud that's been put over on the people. They've picked up, you know, kind of medical quackery and even to some extent drug enthusiasms. You know, you've got Elon Musk walking around clearly high as a kite. And so they're kind of a weird, perverse version of that. And, you know, the truly radical kind of era of the 60s was there was kind of a hard left, you know, kind of Marxist, Maoist political element. There was the kind of Ken Kesey, Merry Pranksters, let's just scare the middle class and shock the respectable people element. And then there was this really sort of dark nihilistic element that you really see the Manson family as being the great expression of. But they're not the only ones. You know, there was all sorts of political violence, terrorism, sniper attacks, bombings, all that stuff. You know, for a while there, I guess in them, it was really more in the 70s when people referred to San Francisco as the Belfast of the West Coast because there was a bombing every day in San Francisco for like 2 years or something like that. That's where the Republicans kind of are. And when I look at something like, say, January 6th, I see, you know, a right-wing version of the same phenomenon that led to, you know, the campus stuff in the 60s, the Manson stuff in the 60s, and some of the you know, nihilistic drug culture stuff in the 60s. You know, the Jane Fonda with the, you know, standing next to the machine gun and doing propaganda for Ho Chi Minh is absolutely of a piece with where the Republicans are now. Just, you know, you make it Putin instead of Ho, and you're right there.
Yeah. Now, you said a minute ago that you think there's an opening at this moment for sort of civic virtue. So you've had some very harsh things to say about the American character, but you must believe that there is at least some residual appetite for or conscience there for, you know, looking for something different.
Well, when I said a market, I meant a literal market, as in I think I could maybe sell some books here.
Oh.
whether there's a political market for that? Yes, there is. It's a small one, I think, though, unfortunately. I'm not sure it's small enough to be important, important electorally at least. And I'm no great analyst of elections and campaigns. That's not what I do. That's not really my business. But if there were a political platform that had some juice to it, that were aligned with those traditional kinds of virtues, somebody would have discovered it already, because those things are already out there laying in front of you. You don't have to dream up any new ideas. Like, you know,
I'm not sure. I mean, they could be looking around.
False witness has been around for a while.
Yeah, it has. It's a good one. But the, you know, the Democrats seem to be sort of flailing and looking around, for example, and saying, well, I guess then in order to be successful in this moment, the thing for us to be is just as cruel, just as vulgar, just as heedless as the other side, rather than thinking, no, the proper thing is to be as different as we can be.
Right. And before the Democrats were telling themselves that, that's where what the Republicans were telling themselves.
Yes.
Before they rallied behind Trump. And so they're saying, well, you know, look at these Democrats. They're so intolerant. They're making sure that books they don't like can't be sold on Amazon, which is a real thing that happened, you know, mm-hmm. Ryan Anderson's book, and making mm-hmm. sure that people who have ideas they don't like can't publish in the New York Times or speak on college campuses. And they're so vicious and so totalitarian and so cruel that we have no choice but to do this. Mm-hmm. And before Republicans were saying that about Democrats, and Democrats were saying that about Republicans, maybe back in the Reagan era or something, or in the Nixon years or whenever. And it's this ratchet that goes, you know, back and forth. And unfortunately, I don't see any way to get off that particular carousel without resort to some unfortunate great man approach to politics, which has its own problems. It is possible to imagine someone who's really very good at politics, who is a kind of, you know, heroic and inspirational figure and who has the right kind of ideas transforming American politics. But you can't plan on something like that because these are, you know, kind of maybe once in a generation sort of figures. You know, if you're India in the 1940s and you're trying to get your independence, you can't just count on Gandhi showing up. And you can't just count on George Washington showing up either. We were lucky that they were there, he and his colleagues. So we can't, you know, sit around and pray for a savior. And of course, saviors always have their own problems anyway, because none of them actually are that. They just feel that way to us. So I suppose there's room for reform at you know, kind of a small level, I think. And there's room for preaching and persuasion, I hope. But the Democratic Party, I think, has the same problem the Republican Party does, which... not to smack around our former friends at National Review, our former employers, but they have the National Review comment section problem, right? That the people in charge of the thing read the comments, and the comments are dominated by the most lunatic, angry, too much time on their hands, meth addict people who are full of irresponsible bile. And they think that's the center. That's, you know, that's where the line of things are. And the Democrats have the same problem because think about who writes the checks, you know, like, you know, your $52,000 a year mechanic down in the Rio Grande Valley is not a guy who writes a lot of very big checks to the Democratic Party. And so Republicans look at them and go, or in some Democrats, some, you know, people like James Carville say, well, why do they go so crazy like on the trans stuff? Like, why did that become such a big thing on their agenda? Well, who writes the checks? Checks are written by people who really care about some of these boutique issues like that. And so it's why the climate issue looms so large, even though I think, you know, environmental issues are legitimate and it's a real issue. The climate issue looms so large in the Democratic Party because the people who make that their number one issue have a lot of money and power. And the people whose number one issue is the cost of eggs don't.
Okay. Now, I think this might be one area where I may have a disagreement with you.
Okay.
So you wrote a piece about this new book by Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein, Abundance. Okay. And
dreadful.
You were very dismissive. And your first point, which was completely fair, is that, and especially from an economics point of view, is, you know, they say, you know, we can have abundance. And you said, you know, the facts of life are that scarcity is the thing that we have to grapple with. There's, if we had abundance of everything, in a kind of redistributionist dead end, where the only thing they've been able to say over and over again is that we need to do more taxing of the rich, to do more redistribution, more programs for people that, you know, need it and so forth, rather than focusing on growth and productivity, and rather than focusing on the obstacles that the government itself puts in the way of economic growth. And this book, in a refreshing way, I believe, is saying we need to look at permitting reform. We need to look at all of these veto points when we want to have any kind of new building or new development where, you know, the environmentalists get a veto and it has to have X amount of minority representation and the contractors all have to have, you know, one woman on the board and whatever. I mean, all those things slow things down horribly. And they were even willing to contrast unfavorably California with all of its crazy regulations with a place like Texas, where, you know, it takes like 1/10 the amount of time to build a building in Texas as it does in California or something like that. These data are in the book. So I'm wondering if you weren't a little too tough on them.
Yeah. I've never met Ezra Klein, and he's got to be a reasonably smart person, I would think. But I find myself, and this is a years long project, I think, of sort of reading Ezra Klein and watching Ezra Klein learn in public. And there's a part of me that just wants to like shake my fist at him and say, have you ever read a book? Because, you know, these are not new ideas. This stuff's been around for a long time, but it's been associated with people that you dismiss or ignore or sneer at or refuse to listen to. And so you've written this whole book about what it really amounts to, a set of public choice problems, without getting in any real public choice thinking, and the people who've done this scholarship before you, and or God forbid, offering them any credit or anything like that. But the problem with that book, besides being badly written and semi-literate, is that it still sits really squarely in the fallacious territory of central planning. You know, their vision for reform is not let's apply a set of neutral, generally applicable rules that are predictable and stable over time and let government do the things government needs to do while minimally interfering with everything else. It's, well, how do we keep doing more or less what we're doing, but in a way that gets the results we want? So, yeah, we should get rid of some red tape and stuff, but only for the stuff that we think is important. And so we're still going to be sitting here over the process, you know, supervising it, superintending it as kind of masters of the universe, and saying, well, we think it's maybe important to have some nuclear power plants because we're going to need desalination because people want to live in California because it's nice and they don't have any water. And but, you know, other kinds of stuff that that isn't as important to us, well, we're not going to worry about that too much. And so what we're going to do is have a series of carve-outs, because having series of carve-outs from the regulations we've been putting in place for the last 100 years has worked so well so far. You know, it's essentially, you know, Marco Rubio is someone who has been just declining just rapidly, in my estimate. His reputation is like Wile E. Coyote having gone over the cliff, and not the 2 seconds before he discovers that he's over the cliff. You know, he's now falling.
He's already at the bottom of the ravine.
He is accelerating at 9.8 meters per second squared toward the bottom of the desert floor. And but, you know, Marco Rubio said something a couple of months ago that we've been having great fun with, saying that, well, actually, I believe in industrial policy and planning now, but done right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you, Senator Rubio, because, you know, for 1,000 years, no one's ever thought, hey, we should have government, but you know what we should do is try to do it right. Just, you know, ludicrous stuff. But that's essentially their position, right, is that we should still have this kind of, you know, managerial state making these kinds of macro economic decisions, favoring this industry, encouraging this thing, discouraging that thing. And but we should have people like us in charge of it, really, essentially.
I don't agree. I don't think that's the takeaway. I think they are easing themselves and maybe the Democratic Party as a whole away from that managerial perspective. They're recognizing the pitfalls.
Yeah, I think it's still a pretty interventionist view. Although here's what I like about recent trends in the Democratic Party. So, you know, if not in fact, in aspiration, the parties have kind of switched places, right? So the Republicans are now the Farmer Labor Party, as the Democratic Party of Minnesota still calls itself. And the Democrats have become the party of what the Republicans used to be in the sort of 1950s, 60s, 70s, up into the kind of Alex P. Keaton era, which is the party of upwardly mobile urban and suburban professionals, you know, college educated people, that sort of thing. And to the extent that this change in the kinds of people with whom the Democratic Party aspirationally or in fact identifies itself will change its ideology and its approach to things, that'll be helpful. So I think that if you're going to be the party of relatively high income people, like the whole degrowther agenda and all that kind of stuff is not going to really catch on very much. And hey, we should have government spending that's 40% of GDP and taxes that are 42% of GDP. Is probably not going to not to catch on that much. And as a friend of mine who's you know, a former Republican, increasingly friendly toward the Democratic Party, remarked some time ago, you know, imagine telling someone in 1980 that you're planning to run for office and your issues are free trade, balanced budget, and things along, and, you know, strong American foreign policy, and you're running as a Democrat because you have to stop the Republicans who are going crazy on this stuff. And nobody would believe you in 1985 if that were the issue. But that's where we are now. So my hope for the Democratic Party is that, like, there'll be like 50 people who all have a subscription to The Economist. And they'll say, okay, that sounds pretty good. We can do that, right? It's socially pretty liberal. It's got a kind of European sensibility, but it's basically responsible and basically liberal in the sense of the word that I like and that you and I would agree on. Yeah. And not everything in The Economist's kind of joint editorial view is where I would want the world to be, but it'd be a huge improvement for the Democratic Party over where they are now. So maybe that should be my political activism project. I should just buy some people's subscriptions to The Economist.
That would be an expensive project. Those subscriptions are not cheap.
They're not. And The Economist, by the way, because it's weekly, is such an indictment, because you'll get to your desk and there'll be like, you know, five copies sitting there and they piled up and you haven't got to them. And I think people cancel that newspaper out of a sense of guilt and shame at the way it, you know, monthly you can kind of get away with, right?
Yeah, no,
but a
weekly, it's true.
It's gonna.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose MasterForce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from MasterForce today. Check out all our MasterForce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. It's going to indict you.
I do love my Economist, I have to say. I mean, we've done a lot on the false nostalgia of the Republicans and how they have this vision of the past that's completely false. Mm-hmm. But the left has one that's false too. And theirs is that we could go back to a 50s kind of world, at least as regards taxes, not social arrangements or that sort of thing. But the union membership they liked, and they like the high taxes, and they think that we can go back to that. And they always point to Scandinavia as their model of how this can all work out really well. And by the way, I'm not saying this in a way to be harsh or dismissive toward them, because honestly, if you look around the world, I mean, there are a lot worse places than Scandinavia, right? And so if you're going to admire, if you're going to admire a society, that's fair. But you've always kept me straight in terms of like what is possible when you look at Scandinavia. And I love one time you had written that, well, Norway is a petro state. I thought, yeah, that's so please elaborate on all of that. If you
will. A couple things about that. Taxes weren't higher in the 1950s than they are now. That's a myth. So there was a statutory top tax rate in the Eisenhower years, like 91% you could get to. Essentially, no one paid it.
No one paid it, right.
So the number, and in some years, literally no one paid it, like no households filed at that level. But most of the times, it was some handful of people. So,
and it wasn't that people were cheating. It was that there were all these carve-outs.
Well, they're cheating too. But
okay.
I mean, they might have been cheating. There was a lot of work put into tax minimization. Taxes as a share of GDP, which is what really matters, was quite a bit lower than it is now. Not radically so, but by a few points, depending on where you are from year to year. Where government spent money was radically different. You know, if you look at the early years of the Eisenhower administration, we're still spending 80% of GDP or 80% of income on, rather 80% of federal spending goes essentially to national security and social services and all the other stuff that we think of as being part of the welfare state writ large adds up to about 20%. Today we're about the opposite of that. You know, we're about 20% on military and things related to that and 80% on everything else. So it's a radically different, situation. There's a lot to be said about specifically the Scandinavian model and also the more broadly kind of developed Western European model of governance. I've spent a lot of time there. I like it. You know, there's, France is not an unlivable hellhole. Neither is Italy, neither is Spain, neither is my beloved Switzerland. But what the Scandinavian countries have in terms of taxes is not what the Democrats are talking about. So the Democrats are talking about, let's radically jack up taxes on people who make very, very high incomes. If you're a billionaire, your taxes in Sweden aren't very different from what they are in the United States. On the other hand, if you're at the 55th percentile, they're about twice in, you know, the Scandinavian countries what they are in the United States. There just isn't really enough money at the very top to do the things the Democrats want to do. So about half, a little more than half of U.S. households don't actually have any liability for federal income tax as such. So all taxes, federal taxes, are essentially paid by the top half of earners. And in Scandinavia, you get a very different situation.
Leaving aside what they pay for Social Security and Medicare.
Right, yeah, just federal income tax as such, not counting the payroll taxes and excises and other sorts of things. Yes, it is true that people of more modest incomes do pay base and taxes, and they pay a lot of indirect taxes. You know, when you tax someone's landlord and they're a renter, the renter pays the tax. We all know this. It's just the way it is. So, you know, tax incidence is a complicated question. But what the Scandinavians do that's different isn't how they tax the rich. It's how they tax the middle classes. And that's broadly true in Western Europe, although not as much as it is in, you know, Sweden, Denmark, those places. I don't think that we've got the kind of political culture where you can get buy-in to do something like that. And also, those countries are better administered than the United States is. You know, we were just talking earlier about reforms in the United States that led to better and more honest kinds of government. But they've got really, really first-rate administration in places like Scandinavia, Denmark. And they also have a lot of localism, which is misunderstood. So, you know, in Sweden, for example, there's not really a national healthcare system. Americans just assume there is because they like the sound of it. A lot of welfare benefits and healthcare, particularly in Sweden, is... they are administered either at the regional level or at the municipal level. And it's a lot easier to do things at a smaller local level than at a big national level, particularly when you've got 340 million people like we do. We're also talking about relatively small countries, which matters a great deal. Some people make a big deal of the kind of, you know, ethnic, linguistic, cultural homogeneity of these places, which I think is a factor, certainly. There are good things that come out of diversity, and there are prices that come out of diversity as well. And Sweden, of course, recently has got a real education in that with their refugee populations. But it's easier for Finland to be Finland than the United States to be Finland. And it's a lot easier for Switzerland to be Switzerland because, you know, it's a very different kind of country. My standard line on this is the difference is that, you know, Switzerland is full of Swiss people and the United States is full of armed alcoholics, you know, and people who like to drive fast and run red lights and that sort of thing. We're just very different kinds of countries. You can see this if you have your eyes open. Like I remember standing on a street corner in Zurich at like 2:30 in the morning, going home after a long evening out. And the light says, do not walk. And there's no car to be seen for a mile in either direction. Yeah. And nobody crosses that street. Right. And if you do, you will get, you know, a talking to. Or like the main train station, like in Zurich, has a traffic circle that goes around it. And there are a bunch of crosswalks. And there are no signals on the crosswalks. It's just if pedestrians walk up to them, traffic stops because that's what you're supposed to do. And that's a cultural thing. No one created that through politics. That's just kind of who they are. And their politics is a product of their culture, not the other way around. And our culture is just way too freewheeling and anarchic and individualistic for that kind of thing to work. It's the same reason why we have this universe of entrepreneurship and venture capital and why all the major tech companies in the world are really, you know, from the United States, particularly the internet companies and not Germany. Germany's got a fine business climate in a lot of ways, and it's got great infrastructure and a good education system and all sorts of other things. And it's a reasonably well-governed country, but it doesn't have the kind of culture that we have that makes this stuff possible. So our prosperity and our outlier murder rate come from the same aspect of our character, I think, that we're an unruly, ungovernable people. And that has good aspects and it has bad aspects. And if you look at the United States on all sorts of weird things you wouldn't think about, like traffic accidents, homicides, not just from firearms, but how often we beat one another to death or stab one another to death or kill each other with fire. We're off the charts compared to the rest of the world, but we're also the only country that has, our weird little universe and ecosystem of venture capital and startup firms and that kind of stuff. And if you're in Germany and you graduate from some elite school and you go like work for a startup, I mean, it's like you failed somewhere, you know, it's like you've done the wrong thing instead of going to work for some, you know, great big, German industrial monolith of some kind. It's a very deeply imprinted cultural thing. Someone once put it, the difference is we're the descendants of the people who left and they're all the descendants of the people who stayed behind.
Yes.
And I think that's a simplification, obviously, but there's something to it.
Yeah. I used to be sort of a reflexive America defender, I will confess. You know, I would, any international comparison, my instinct was to say, yes, but, you know, sure enough. Right? I have become a lot more jaundiced in recent years.
How could you not?
About the American character. And that much having been said, and this isn't an endorsement necessarily, but it is just a fact that still continues to amaze me. Speaking of our beloved economist, they ran a cover story in 2024, whose title was The Envy of the World, about the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. And it is still true that despite all of our problems, the average standard of living for Americans is so much higher than any other country, even higher than Switzerland, rich little Switzerland.
And we've been pulling away from Europe specifically in the UK and but also the other developed countries. The Scandinavian countries are a good example of something that we undervalue, I think, which is that a little bit of capitalist reform goes a long way. So, in the 1970s, in Sweden, Norway, these countries, they were essentially, social democracies. They were socialist countries, more or less, with democratic governments. And it was a mess. Didn't work out well for them. They were in dire straits in a lot of ways. At one point it wasn't that long ago that Sweden was one of the poorest countries in Europe. It just was. But they had some important reforms from the 70s through the 90s. And in some ways, they're more capitalistic countries than the United States is. And that kind of, innovation and dynamism and prosperity has allowed them to thrive in a lot of important ways. In spite of still having a relatively high tax burden, relatively high regulatory burden, relatively large welfare state, and a culture that doesn't have as much entrepreneurship as we do. The flip side of that is that the United States has made a lot of bad decisions since the 1960s, 1970s. A lot of the Johnson, welfare state stuff was, I think, really badly designed, misbegotten, badly conceived. We've run up enormous debts. We have lowered our standards and our expectations for what government should do. We've lowered our moral standards and our standards of expectations for effectiveness and transparency in these things. We've been governed by this game show host who's appeared in no fewer than three pornographic films, I might point out, and as a pro wrestling heel. And yet somehow we keep, soldiering through. And that's an interesting thing about how powerful a lot of capitalism is, that if you look at U.S. economic performance, under Reagan, under Clinton, under George W. Bush, under George H.W. Bush, under Barack Obama, under Joe Biden, under Donald Trump, it kind of looks the same.
Yeah.
In fact, I guess even if you I may be wrong about the numbers here. I ran this a while back. But if you even if you exclude the COVID quarters, you get almost the same GDP growth in the first Trump administration as you do in the Biden administration. They look very, very similar. We have a few weird outliers here and there. But, if you look at what the economy did during the Obama years versus what it did during the George W. Bush years, not radically different. And the 90s were kind of a special case. We had some unusual things that happened then that didn't really mainly have to do with politics. They had to do with the emergence of the internet and the things that went along with it. But we've gotten an amazing economy. And that's the weird contradiction of Americans, who as voters are like some of the dumbest people in the world, and who as almost everything else are pretty great. We invent all sorts of cool stuff. We do all sorts of cool stuff. Every good, interesting thing in the modern world, almost all of it comes from the United States in the 20th century and the early 21st century, from the internet.
Do you think all of that is in danger? Defunding, absolutely, basic research, cutting ourselves off from world trade, all of these things that the idiotic Trump administration is now doing, is it putting it all at risk?
Yeah, I think that we have a major political tendency in the United States, one that you and I have long been associated with, a branch of it, at least, is America first. We love America. America is what matters, except we hate all the cities, all universities, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, the Ivy League, the people who live there, the people who associate with them,
Hollywood,
the places where the people and the money are. And what we like is sorghum farmers in Mule Shoe, Texas. Those are our people. And I love Mule Shoe, Texas. It's a nice little town. And sorghum farmers, some of my best friends are sorghum farmers. But it's not the future, right? And so the Democrats have a real opportunity there because that's their people now, right? So the Republicans hate the parts of the country that work. I mean, they really do. They hate all of the functional institutions. And it's not that there aren't enormous number of things to criticize about higher education and Wall Street and the cities,
sure,
and the whole kind of, liberal consensus world. There's lots of criticism to be done there, but they're not criticizing it. They're just holding it in contempt and trying to destroy it. And that's an enormous mistake. If you didn't have the American university system and you could just invent it, you'd invent it, right? If Germany could spend a year's worth of GDP and at the end of that year have just the beginnings of what we have here in terms of our education system, our higher education system specifically, and our little universe of venture capital and techno startups, they'd do that in a heartbeat. And it'd be the best investment they ever made, right? And we're trying to kill it.
Yeah.
Because we want people to work in tire factories.
Exactly.
You know who wants people to work in tire factories? People who've never been in a tire factory. And whose kids are never going to work in a tire factory and whose grandkids are never going to see a tire factory or live downwind from one.
Yeah.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
All right. Let us close out with some reflections on a truly historic event that happened just this past few days. Namely, an American has become Pope. And you, I believe, are a Catholic. And so I thought it would be interesting to hear your reflections on this. It has been presented as, you know, the old saying was that there would never be an American Pope unless America were in decline, which is chilling because, boy, you can make that case. But what do you make of it? And how are you feeling about it?
You know, I don't know that much about Cardinal Prevost, who's now Pope Leo. He seems like a decent enough guy. He seems to be, you know, he's probably on Twitter more than he needs to be, I think. And I think that one of the things they should do, like, you know, I don't know how much you know about the ritual, but when a Pope dies, they take off his signet ring and they smash it so no one can use the official, you know, papal seal until the next one is made for the next Pope.
Did not know that.
At the same time, they should as soon as someone is elected Pope, they should go, like, delete all his social media accounts before the smoke and tell him no more. You can't do this anymore. Just get off that.
Yeah.
And you've got all sorts of ways to communicate with the world. You can go out on the balcony. And that's your Twitter now, is the balcony. And you've got that. It's interesting to see. I kind of like that he's a Midwesterner. So I kind of imagine him, you know, bringing some of that sensibility to the job. Although I guess he hasn't really lived in the United States in a long time. And True. he's a naturalized Peruvian citizen, I want to say.
Well, I think I could be wrong. I read that he had to become a Peruvian citizen in order to continue his work for the church there.
Yes, that's my understanding.
So he has dual citizenship.
Yeah, which the United States doesn't recognize. But that's another issue. It'll be interesting to see a Pope who can communicate in idiomatic English. I think one of the main things that changed the United States relationship with Israel over the course of 20 years or so was Netanyahu's English. I think that's just an enormously important thing. I mean, most Israelis speak English, obviously, but he spoke like an American.
Yes.
And I think that'll make, I mean, there have been a lot of popes who spoke fine English. Maybe not a lot, but a few. And one of the things I don't like, it's a trend in the Catholic Church for a long time now, is this sort of ultramontanism, which, you know, an undue focus on the papacy and the Pope, in the same sense that the president is not the United States of America.
Right.
And the more we lean into that, the further wrong we go. The Catholic Church is not the Pope. There have been some great popes. There have been heroic popes in our lifetime. You know, John Paul II, obviously, mm-hmm. is an example of that. There have been some pretty bad popes. And the truth remains the truth, irrespective of whether the Pope is a good guy or a bad guy, whether he's good at his job, whether he's bad at his job. And the complicating factor, of course, is that the Pope is an administrator and a politician. There have been some popes who weren't very good guys who were pretty good popes, in the sense that there have been some presidents who weren't very good men who were pretty good presidents. And there were some kings in history who weren't decent guys, but they were good kings. And there were some popes who were truly saintly men who were very, very bad at the job and probably should have been removed. So he seems to be very much his own man, I think, which is a good thing. I mean, obviously he was part of Francis's orbit, but he doesn't seem to be, an acolyte, I suppose. My hope for him and my prayer for him is that he will understand what the job is and do the job. I've become very much a, as we all are, as all good thinking people are, a Yuval Levin guy on the subject of institutions and their role. And the papacy is a great example of that, that you are here to be shaped by and serve this church not to use it as a platform for your own idiosyncratic views or political preferences or whatever your personal agenda is. And to the extent that he can submerge himself in that, which is why they pick a new name, and it's why they give you a uniform, and it's why they do all these things to kind of, you know, erase your individuality the same way we do with judges in the black robes, at least as an official matter.
And with priests and the collar. I mean, that's same thing.
That's part of the idea. So I hope that's what he does. I mean, he's a relatively young man for that job. And so we might be around for a while.
Oh, I have to say, I mean, I love the fact that, you know, everybody was saying, and he's so young. He's a year older than I am.
Yeah. And who's it? Someone was remarking that he could be Pope for 20 years and still probably plausibly be a U.S. presidential candidate at the end of it.
Yes.
And, so that would be good. No, he seems like a likable enough guy. And yeah.
Okay, so can I just give my prayer for the Pope, even though I'm a non-Catholic? I do hope that he will represent to the whole world a kind of American who is non-MAGA and who, you know, does keep in mind the immigrant and the poor and the persecuted and speaks up for them as a good Pope should, as any good, decent person should. But since he is now arguably, you know, the second most well-known American on the planet, he has an opportunity.
Behind Taylor Swift, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. He has an opportunity to play that role, and I hope he does.
I don't think, by the way, you should have to feel like you need to introduce your prayers as a non-Catholic. Little known fact, the top guy in our church is Jewish.
All the top guys are always Jewish.
Everywhere.
All right. Kevin Williamson, thank you so much for joining me. This has been just great.
Always a pleasure.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.